Welcome back. In the 17th and 18th centuries, tens of thousands of British, Irish and Scottish were forcibly rounded up and they died in bondage in Britain's American colonies. If they managed to escape, they were hunted down by their masters and wanted notices were posted in local gazettes.
Runaway from the subscriber living in Lancaster, a native Irish servant woman named Katie Norton, who came from the county of Wicklow in Ireland last fall. She is about 25 or 26 years of age, of a dark complexion, has black hair, talks in the Irish dialect, rocks in her walk, and is pretty sharp in talking. She is a cunning hussy, and no doubt will pass a while for an honest woman, as she has good clothes with her and can behave herself. Whoever takes up said woman and brings her to the subscriber in Lancaster shall have £3 reward and reasonable charges paid by me, Robert Fulton, July 1763.
She rocks in her walk and she's a cunning hussy. We will hear more about that lady a little bit later on in the programme. The trade in human cargo included prostitutes, beggars, homeless children and other undesirables who were forcibly transported to places like Virginia and Maryland. Hopeful migrants were also duped into signing as indentured servants, unaware that they would become chattels who could be bought, sold or even gambled away when they arrived in the New World. Our April book club choice is White Cargo, The Forgotten History of Britain's White Slaves in America by Don Jordan and Michael Walsh. And here to discuss it, our UCD historian Lindsay Erna-Byrne, Margaret Ward, Managing Director of Clear Inc., and our former Washington correspondent Richard Downs. You're all very welcome indeed. Richard, the book focuses on Virginia and Maryland, where the indentured servant system was created, and it begins in the early 1600s. Just give us an idea of what was going on in the US at that time. Put it into context for us.
Well, there had been, of course, a Spanish settlement of some sort, mostly down in Florida and in various other parts, but largely it was the US, or the American continent, as we know it, was undisturbed by colonization at that stage. And we had significant and a whole series of waves of colonization beginning in, I think, 1607 or 8 with the Jamestown settlement, a pretty disastrous one, as it turned out. And that was spearheaded by the Virginia Company, which was a company set up in the city of London, which was specifically organized to settle Virginia and to exploit what was becoming clear was the crop of choice, which was tobacco. There are many others, of course, but tobacco became a commodity that they really wanted to kind of exploit and to develop. They had gone originally in the very early 1600s with this idea of gold. There was a gold fever gripping London at the time. Of course, London would have been, the guilds controlled London, and the Virginia Company was made up largely of members of those guilds. So Virginia was very much the focus, and the early story of the settlement of America in those first few decades, it's absolutely shocking. I don't know what the percentage of people who survived to the age of 30 would be, but at one stage I was looking through and I was thinking maybe 10, maybe 15, maybe 20%, if they weren't killed by scurvy or by whatever shipborne diseases they had coming over in the ships. They died of malaria and various other ailments.
While at the same time wreaking havoc on the native inhabitants by spreading diseases with which they were unfamiliar.
Absolutely,
and to which
yeah.
they were
So vulnerable. It was a very turbulent time, and it was speculative capitalism red in tooth and claw. That was the basis for the exploitation of America. Contrary to what many people are taught about the settlement of America being a idealistic place where
nice Puritans who landed in New England. That's yeah. That's
there are two distinct phases, of course. Yeah. But it's interesting that history has chosen to look at one and perhaps turn a blind eye to the other.
Now the authors work chronologically, Lindsay. They begin with England's Vagrancy Act in 1597. You might wonder what the Vagrancy Act has anything to do with this story, but we'll find out. Under this, persistent rogues, was the phrase that was used, could be banished to the fledgling colonies. And by 1618, street children, whether they were persistent rogues or not, were being rounded up and sent off to work in the tobacco fields of Virginia. So it was essentially kidnapping, wasn't it?
It was, yeah. And at first there was very little protest because they would snatch isolated children and children who were usually sort of begging or wandering around the streets, and the first few weren't noticed. Eventually, though, it did cause significant protest at home, but it didn't stop it. It was to go on for another 300 years. But just to pick up on what Richard was saying there, the first 300 children who were shipped between 1619 and 1622, according to the authors of this book, only 12 of them were still alive by 1624. So you're talking about an absolutely massive mortality rate. And these children seemed, I mean, the term white cargo is quite a good one in a sense, because they literally were shipped like livestock. The intention with children was both to work them, but also hopefully to use them for breeding. Mm. And so there's a dual purpose, but so few of them actually survived old enough, I imagine, to be of any potential in terms of parents. But those that did, and that was the interesting thing that I didn't know, the children who were indentured for a period of time, many of them to the age of 21, by the way, not just 7 years, which the other servants would be, but if they had any children by their owners, those children born into indentured servitude would be kept until the age of 21 as well. So it was a self-fulfilling thing. It generated new workers, if you like.
And Margaret, this became the subject of literature. Daniel Defoe, Robert Louis Stevenson wrote about it and wrote novels about it.
They did. And there was, besides, you know, the children who were being taken, and there were some, actually, there was one story from Baltimore where a woman said her husband had gotten these three children to come over to work in the house. And she wondered why they didn't send cradles as well, because these children were so young, you
and
know,
they were Irish,
two
weren't
or
they?
Three. They were Irish yeah. children that it didn't understand. And also after that, then, because this was such a lucrative cargo, these children who, you know, may have been out playing on the street or whatever, they weren't the only ones rounded up, or, you know, it wasn't under the law. Then kidnapping also started to happen. And, you know, kind of towards the middle of the book, they talk about people being spirited away.
These weren't children.
There were con men, and I thought very interesting, con women who would kind of go and say, oh, yes, you know, there's some great opportunities, and why don't you come over here? And at one stage, there was such hysteria around people who lived around the ports and their children that people were falsely being accused of spiriting people's children away.
And there was also the key point which underlines all of this, which was that when somebody brought children or whoever they were, indentured servants, into Virginia or Maryland or any of the other states in New England, they were given head rights. So if I brought 30 servants in, depending on where you were, you could get up to 100 acres of land free. Which is why you paid for those indentured servants to come in. And then you would put them to work on this land which had just been granted to you, virgin land, as it were, except it was owned by the Native Americans settled by the Native Americans. And those people were used to expand, those indentured servants were used to expand the colony and to create this new civilization in America. And the people paid money because these people settled the land, and it was very obvious reading the book and from the evidence presented that it was the understanding of the landlords that a lot of these people would die anyway, and they would get to keep the land and much of it too. So it was a win-win situation, if you like, for the landlords.
And the profit margins were extraordinary, right? So you would pay for somebody to be transported over to the American colonies and say it was 20 quid. But they could make 60 quid profit from these individuals, the ones who lived, you know, picking tobacco. So even though they were often told, oh, it's 7 years of indentured servitude, then when that came up, sometimes that didn't happen because they were so lucrative. So, I mean, it was amazingly...
The convict trade was even more lucrative because they got paid five... I'm jumping a bit because it's a little bit later, but they got paid £5 per head to get rid of these people. It didn't matter if they survived the voyage. So they, you know, they really were subjected to some of the worst treatment in transport.
But just there's an issue, I suppose, at the heart of the book. There's a question at the heart of the book. And the question, I suppose, is were these actually slaves? They may be white cargo, but the forgotten history of Britain's white slaves in America... Was an indentured servant a slave, Richard?
Well, if you said to an 11-year-old, which I did recently, and described the conditions of these poor people being transported to America, the answer is undoubtedly yes, they're slaves. But of course, we have to be careful. The term slavery and the term slave is a very important one in American history because it denotes a very significant group of people in the United States who were brought over, where the successors, if you like, like of slaves, and their history, you know, didn't stop in the 17th and 18th century. They remained curtailed right the way up to the 60s, as we know. And it's a very sensitive subject. And there are people, very small numbers in the United States, who basically say slavery was not a big deal, and who try and play down, and it's a kind of a racial game that they play and try to play down black slavery. And I think the authors of this book are very careful not to fall into that trap of saying, well, black slavery wasn't a big deal. Look, there were lots of other people in terrible conditions. But I think that's separate to the simple reality, which is that these people were in a form of bondage, which is very close to slavery. Mm. It wasn't the slavery.
They could be maltreated.
They could be maltreated. They could be bought and sold, of course, which meant that they weren't in
any
way.
They could be bound, literally.
Literally be bound. And many of them were on whipping posts. Apparently, every settlement in Virginia and Maryland had its own little whipping post. But I think fundamentally and most importantly, they had the prospect of becoming free, which puts a little bit of a dent in the argument of the authors. That many of them didn't become free. Huge numbers of them died in servitude, but also their progeny had the prospect of becoming free, which is a very important point, because the progeny of slaves, the children of slaves, never had the prospect of becoming free. It's very important.
Do both of you agree with that, or is there a flaw at the heart of the book that an indentured servant is not necessarily, or is not the same thing as a slave, is not the same thing as slavery, as Richard was saying?
I think Richard sums it up quite well. I mean, the authors do make distinctions. They do make that distinction that Richard just made there, that these people did stand the prospect of freedom at some point, but they do say very few of them ever achieved that, because if they ran away, if they misbehaved, they could have a year added, 2 years added, 3 years added. What I found really interesting about their argument, because they are uncomfortable, they haven't dealt with it thoroughly enough in my view. They only reference black slavery and the difference between black slavery and this form of what they call white slavery about three or four times in the book, and I do think that should have been a much deeper, they should have considered it much more deeply. But one thing they do say is they actually talk about the fact that in the early stages of this form of bondage, blacks were also indentured servants. Mm. They also stood the prospect of freedom. And in fact, they give the example of one African called Anthony Johnson. I think he was Angolan, but I'm not sure. And he actually...
Well, he called his settlement Angolan.
Yeah, oh, that's right. So there's a good giveaway there. But he actually he was an indentured servant. He got his freedom. He then had his own indentured servants. And one of his black servant ran away. And when he was caught, he brought him in front of the court and petitioned the court to have that black slave enslaved for life. And they give this as one of the isolated examples during this period of blacks becoming enslaved for life. And they say that this period in the mid-1600s is crucial to that transformation towards racial slavery.
But they also make the point that Anthony Johnson had white slaves. Or
yes,
white
absolutely, white
servants.
And black, yes. But he didn't have them enslaved for life. And what they say is that these cases become much more common during the 1660s, 1670s of blacks being enslaved for life as a form of punishment when they run away. And they give plenty of examples of Dutch, Scots and English running away, being whipped all right, having several years added onto their servitude, in some cases being whipped to death, I might add. But that the blacks, they start to increasingly enslave the blacks permanently.
Is it a very 21st century or late 20th century story, Margaret, in a sense? This kind of slavery that we're talking about here is very like the sort of white slavery, or slavery that is not white slavery necessarily, but slavery that's written about in the 21st century.
Yeah, I have to say I was really struck by the modern parallels, because you read these stories about, you know, the people who are spiriting them away. So, you know, think about the ads that people are seeing, you know, in very poor countries in the world saying, oh, there's a job opening for a waitress in London, you know, and they apply for this job and they think this is great. I can get out of, you know, poverty and wherever they're living in Asia, excuse me,
Moldova.
Or Africa, Moldova, you know, Eastern Europe. And they reply. And what actually happens is they're sold into, you know, sexual slavery. They're forced to become prostitutes. You also have cases in Ireland where these kind of marijuana grow houses have been found with people locked inside. But then those people are prosecuted, even though they claim that they have been enslaved and they've been locked in there, you know, for weeks at a time with just water and a little bit of food. So, you know, slavery, we think, oh, slavery's gone away. You know, there was just that terrible slavery, you know, in America and the Caribbean. But I don't think slavery's ever gone away. They just call it something else. You know, if there's an opportunity for people, bad people, you know, to make money out of other people's human suffering, it seems that through most of time that has happened. I mean, from what the building of the Egyptian pyramids, you know, right up until today. So these indentured servants, and what's interesting with the indentured servants is that in the UK, You know, maybe their rights to become free were upheld, but because America was so far away and it wasn't under the direct rule, really, of the crown, it was the company was given power over them. And they increasingly became crueler and crueler to them as time went on and stripped their rights away.
Okay, text from Sean. He said, we had our own slaves in Ireland. We called them the non-free classes, the bottom rung of the five classes in Irish society as recognised by the Brehon Laws. They could till a plot of land of their own to survive in exceptional circumstances. It was the law. Richard, there are lots of Irish references in this book, and there were lots of Irish people who were part of this white slave traffic.
It's extraordinary numbers of Irish people. I mean, the subtitle of the book's a bit annoying, isn't it? The Forgotten History of Britain's White Slaves in America. I suppose they're making the point there that at the time Ireland was a colony of Britain, part of Britain, as it were. But it is a bit annoying in the contemporary field. But what was interesting was whatever was happening in England and in Scotland was happening in Ireland too. So it was really, truly the one venture, the one escapade. When kidnapping became an epidemic, Dublin is referenced constantly. People wandering aimlessly who might have had a couple of drinks down near Sir John Rogers' Quay in Dublin were quite likely to find themselves on a ship very, very quickly and turning up in Maryland or New York
or in Her Majesty's Navy or His Majesty's Navy,
of course, which was the other
press ganging
job that was done. So, what's also interesting is that there are people with Irish connections at all levels. It isn't just the indentured servants who are Irish. And we have this narrative of history, which is a kind of, in some ways, a kind of victim narrative that we only ever concentrate on the people who have had terrible things happen to them, who have been exploited. Quite a number of the exploiters were Irish too, or had Irish connections, be it William Penn founding Pennsylvania or whatever. All people had Irish connections, and they were also part of this enterprise. And so, and the thing which really comes back to me all the way along is the disconnect between this book, and it's kind of a polemical work. There's a disconnect between what its argument and the reality of discourse in America about their history. In America, nobody talks about this. It is not part of the discourse. Nobody says, indentured servitude was very close to slavery. Absolutely not. Indentured servitude is a kind of a benign term, almost. You were almost working off your passage. You were paying for your passage over to America. You were kind of lucky because you came to America, the land of the home and the brave and the free. And that is really the most striking thing about it. It's a very, very, very fine work in that respect because it's pricked my attention.
You had
a
long education in America.
I did. I did 27 years of an education in America. We were very much taught, the founding of Jamestown, and this was a wonderful thing. And, you know, then you had, you know, New England and the Puritans, and they were very well known for hard work, temperance, you know, modesty. But the reality of what these authors have found is that actually the people who were doing the hard work were the indentured servants, and they were actually being worked to death, or they were being killed, you know, by Indians in Maryland and Virginia, and there wasn't much care given to them in terms of even food.
And they were deliberately put in those areas where to settle them and to confront, if you like, the Native Americans.
Absolutely. And I mean, a huge, huge numbers of them died. And are for, you know, I think they said the Algonquin Indians may have killed, say, up to 25% of those who came. But there were, in one stage, there were 3,000 that were unaccounted for. The mortality rates were absolutely huge. But it is fascinating that the authors are throwing this, you know, like a bomb into the discourse of the founding of America. So, you know, we were never taught anything about, you know, white slavery. We were taught, indentured servants, not about the colonies, but just in general. But that's, you know, terminology like collateral damage for murder. You know, indentured servants just as a whitewash of the word, you know.
The authors do say that the planters, the settlers, got away with murder. And that's literally the case, isn't it, Lindsay?
It seems to be they actually start the book. It's quite evocative, and it's very much what they're trying to do. They start the book with this archaeological dig in 2003 in a 17th century house in Virginia that discovers this body, and after they test it, they realise that it's the body of a 16-year-old Northern European with an infection in his mouth, with tuberculosis, with herniated discs on his back, with injuries indicative of torture and very hard work. And they basically conclude that this child was a dumped indentured servant. He's actually found under a pile of rubbish. But they do, they literally do. They also get away with a massive amount of sexual exploitation. The authors only touch on that. They do make reference to the fact that that part of slavery, generally speaking, falls heaviest on women. But there are some really horrendous cases, and women who were raped by their masters were held responsible for that, and they would get an extra 2 years added on to their period for basically burdening their masters with a child. So, and a couple of women, what I did find interesting was, as early as the 1620s, there are examples of indentured servants seeking some kind of retribution for what happens to them. And there is the beginning, by 1640, you do have people, lawyers or advocates, actually representing them, now often not very successfully, but it does show you, even in that very early period, there was a consciousness that this was not all okay. Mm. And there was at least a rhetorical nod towards some form of humanity, although they don't seem to have achieved it very often.
The story of Anne Glover, Margaret, is kind of at the extreme end of what might happen to Irish Catholic, let's call them slaves, in North America. Tell us about her.
Yeah, Anne Glover, they think that she kind of was sent over around 1650 to Massachusetts, and she worked for a family called the Goodwins, and she was minding the children, and one of the children kind of complained of having a sore neck, and then another one, and doctors were sent, and they couldn't find any explanation for this sore neck, so they said it must be witchcraft. So they looked at this woman, Anne Glover, they asked her, could she recite the Lord's Prayer in English? This was to test whether or not she was a witch. Now, this would have been an Irish-speaking woman who could not recite the Lord's Prayer in English, so they also kind of went and searched her quarters, and they found knitted dolls, which they thought meant, you know, demonic possession, or that she was using these, I guess, almost like voodoo dolls. And they believed that some of her skills were that she could make children fly and ride on invisible horses. So this proved that it was witchcraft and that she'd practiced witchcraft on these children. And this Irish woman was hanged. Mm.
There are a number of very poignant stories, one in particular, a letter, I think, grabbed your attention, Lindsay. Tell us about that.
Yeah, it did. I mean, the longest history that runs right throughout this is the fate of children, I think, boys and girls, although most, they were called duty boys, a quarter of them are actually girls. And there's one case they talk about, Elizabeth Spriggs, and she wrote a letter home to her father in 1756, which is so poignant, in which she begs his forgiveness for the trouble that she caused him. So I presume that she was probably convicted of a petty crime. They don't know, but they presume that's why she was sent over. And she begs him to send her clothes. She's so freezing cold. And that's all she asks, if he has any paternal feeling left for her. And the really sad thing is that this letter never reached her father, because it was intercepted during the French-English War, and it was actually held for 300 years and never got there. And we now have, I suppose, benefit of that source, because it never received her father never received it. But it's so moving, because in a way it has a resonance of modern childhood in it. She's a disobedient child, and yet she was able to sort of write this letter, however crudely. There's other evocative portrayals. You started the show with one there of the ad for the escaped slave, but there are quite a few portrayals of slaves in that way. And then there are parents whose children have been kidnapped who advertise for those children.
And one interesting aspect of the book as well is that this was kind of a social engineering project to begin with, right? So that they took, you know, people who were vagrants. There were huge problems with poverty and homelessness in London. It was very unseemly.
So you solve one problem somewhere else.
Them and the convicts. And in Ireland, right, Cromwell used this to his advantage. Of course, his ethnic cleansing policy. This allowed him to get rid of rebels in Ireland, supply the New World with cheap labor, and it got rid of the poor. And they thought, well, getting rid of disease and everything as well.
And in the case of Cromwell, there would have been a theological justification for that as well, because they would have been Roman Catholic. And Edward in Waterford asked the question, is there any mention of theological justification for indentured servants?
It comes right through from the very, very beginning. It drips through, it cascades through even. And basically the project of the settlement of the new America, American world, was basically a very, in the way people wrote about it, a very narrow Protestant vision of a new country, interestingly kind of idealistic lake country where everybody would be living off the fruit of the land and having a wonderful time and all the rest, of course, not taking into fact that so many of them were brought over in a form of bondage and servitude and all the rest. And then those who were, for example, convicted and brought over as convicts as the 18th century kicked in, they were convicted of the most extraordinary offences. One boy who was a tavern keeper or tavern assistant or something had brought home some food that was left over and was going to be thrown out, and he brought it home and he was convicted for that, and he was transported to America for that. So the idealism, which was all very cast in this kind of puritanical Protestant way, the reality was quite the opposite, in fact.
There's also an interesting piece towards the right before the American Revolution, which was in 1776. So in the early, I think, 1770s, people realized that all the convicts were being dumped in the American colonies, and people were raging. They said, "Why are you sending these people over?" And there was something called jail fever, which was a horrible form of typhoid that spread like wildfire, and it was only in the English jails. And they said, "Why are you doing this to this? You wouldn't do this to, you know, your daughters and sons. Why are you doing this to us?" So I think it was Benjamin Franklin decided that enough was enough. And he said, for every convict that is sent over from London, we will send them back a rattlesnake. But he said, the good thing about a rattlesnake is a rattlesnake announces when it is going to bite. It gives you warning, unlike the convicts who are being sent over here to kind of lay waste to our lands and our lives.
But the two laws that were enacted by the colonies at the time to counteract the dumping of people, convicts and the like, were both repealed within hours of being notified to the Privy Council in London. So it showed that it was yet another one of those evidences that America was pushing away and London was trying to keep them close.
And when does the practice end, Lindsay?
Well, I mean, according to this book, it sort of peters out by the end of the 1700s, 1800, early 1800s. But in fact, I think we've got evidence that that this idea of moving people around the colony like pawns continues well into the 20th century, if you consider children being sent to Canada and Australia as late as the 1920s and 1930s. But they say that economics kills this form of white indentured servitude about 1820 is when they date it. Mm. I think the most interesting thing that they do say towards the end, though, in coming back to the central message of the book, is that they say this form of indentured servitude taught the planters how to use violence on human beings to exploit labour, and this lesson they used to perfect black slavery. Mm. And that's, I think, the most chilling idea.
And
it
also taught them how to use labour and how to price labour, because
exactly.
That was a problem for them right the way through all these plantation owners. It took them a long time to work out how to perfect sugar production in the Caribbean and tobacco production in Virginia. And they used the white servants, and gradually at various times, black slaves were more valuable than white servants because this allowed them to realise that they wanted more black slaves, and the white servants became less important to them.
And apparently we are revisionists. Somebody texts in to say those with Irish connections doing this wrong were the Protestant English from Ireland. The indentured were the native Irish, the lower orders. I think we did suggest that in the case of Oliver Cromwell. However, down in St. John Rogerson's Quay, I don't think they would have asked whether you were Catholic or Protestant before they kidnapped you and brought you away to the New World. Margaret Ward, Lindsay Erner-Byrne and Richard Downs, thank you very much indeed for joining us to discuss White Cargo, The Forgotten History of Britain's White Slaves in America by Don Jordan and Michael Walsh. It's published by Mainstream. Full details on our website. And our May Book Club choice for the 25th of May is somebody else who made a long trip, Jail Journal by John Mitchell. It's available on Google Books or as a PDF download. Details also on our website. After the break, we hear about the case of the Kerry Babies 30 years on.